It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The United States ranks behind dozens of other countries in literacy. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, 1 in 6 American adults has low literacy skills. In Wisconsin, that number is lower than the national average, with 7% at a low literacy level. There's a lot that goes into the problem, and our next guest says a big part of the solution can happen long before kids even start school. In her new book, she shares advice to help get kids ready for reading starting at age 0. We're listening back to our conversation with her now, and you could let us know your reading story by emailing ideas@WPR.org. What do you remember about learning how to read? Looking back, are there things you think were missing from your reading education? If you have kids, how have you helped them learn to read? What's worked? What hasn't? And if you teach young students, love to hear your story and what you think. Email ideas@WPR.org. Maya Payne Smart is a Milwaukee-based literacy advocate and affiliated faculty in educational policy and leadership in the College of Education at Marquette University. Her new book is called Reading for Our Lives, a Literacy Action Plan from Birth to 6. We talked with her this summer. To start with, you're kind of sounding the alarm on the importance of starting on literacy way before school starts. Tell us why that's so important.
It's so important for parents and educators and everyone really in our community to start thinking about reading with infants and toddlers, because so much brain development happens in those early years. And so much of the groundwork that supports future reading success happens long before kids can make sense of text on a page.
How much difference does it make for that kid? Say they're just hitting kindergarten. How much difference does it make to have a background in some of this pre-literacy learning that they might get from their parents or from a child care center?
It makes a huge difference. There are numerous studies that document a positive correlation between things like the number of letter names that a child knows at kindergarten entry and their reading ability down the road, because all of these skills kind of build on one another. And so the vocabulary that parents can introduce first orally, language development supports literacy development down the road. But all of those words that parents are speaking to kids, whether reading a book or just engaging in conversation in everyday life, contributes to the words that they'll be able to recognize and print down the road. And then there are so many other skills, the ability to discern sounds within words or the ability to recognize different letter shapes. All of those things contribute to reading down the road. And so it's important for parents to have an understanding of how it unfolds over time.
We'll dig into a lot of the practical advice you give in the book. One more point I want to get to before we do that is, yeah, it's been a day or two since my kids were that little. But I remember, you know, when I'd read to them, I'd like, great, this is the magic ingredient. Reading to them is going to do it. Reading your book, reading to kids is great, but we need a little more. Why isn't just reading to them going to do the job?
I think many parents are in the same boat that you were in, where you think of the book as this magical device and also this magical experience with your child. So it's just important to remember that it's really about you and the child and the relationship and that dynamic exchange back and forth with them. So the book is important to the extent that it prompts conversation and to the extent that they're paying attention to some of the print on the page. But the magic is really in that relationship. And so I, in the book, devote 2 chapters actually to the power of conversation and talk, just to really emphasize that point to parents, that it's not just about the words that we're saying, whether we're speaking aloud or narrating what we're doing during the day. It's about that turn taking, the back and forth, serve and return duet of conversation with the child. And when we ask questions, it gives them a chance to formulate responses and, again, build those brain connections that are so important down the road.
Talking to Maya Payne Smart about her new book. It's called Reading for Our Lives, a Literacy Action Plan from Birth to 6, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Were there things you did to encourage literacy, maybe for your own kids, in that preschool era? Do you have questions for our guest? Are you a new parent? Maybe you need some advice. I know I did. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. And Maya, yeah, when I saw age, you know, from birth to 6, I thought, well, wait, how can kids be reading at birth? Well, they can't. But you were just talking about that idea of modeling conversation, a back and forth between a parent and a kid before that kid can even talk. Can you spell out how that works?
Absolutely. So it's important for parents to recognize all of the attempts at communication that their infant is making. So while your three-month-old isn't going to respond in words or sentences, they will give you coos and babbles that indicate their engagement and indicate their learning. So if we treat those babbles as conversation or respond to those and ask questions and just proceed as if it's a typical conversation with words, we're creating so many wonderful learning opportunities for that child. And I think it's also important for parents to recognize that when the littlest babies are slapping at the book or chewing it, throwing it, all of that is important exposure to books, but also important sensory learning for the child. So don't discount that.
And speaking of those books, me reading to a kid, great. Letting the kid interact, you say, is really the key. Talk about ways we can do that starting at an early age.
Kids are learning when they're interested in paying attention and engaged. So hearing the story, they're going to pick up wonderful vocabulary and knowledge and background information. When they're older, let's say 3 or 4, and they start to pay attention to the print, and you're dragging your finger from left to right, that's teaching them something about print, or you're showing that the text moves from left to right or top to bottom of the page. There are just so many lessons within the book objects. But again, the parent brings the lesson alive by paying attention to the child, noticing what they're interested in, and responding with words and gestures.
And so it can be things like point at the dog or help me turn the page or whatever is age appropriate, right?
Absolutely. And the age appropriate piece is so important because there's so much growth and development that happens from birth, which is why I started the book mentioning from birth all the way to 6 years, because learning does look different at different ages. That 12 to 14 month old may be pointing to familiar characters or objects in the book, or they might point to things that they want you to name. They may be beginning to hold a crayon and make marks, the beginning of writing. So when parents have a little more knowledge about what's going on developmentally with children, they're better able to help the child get to the next level. And to your point earlier, we're not advocating that babies can read, but we are saying that parents can nurture future reading through this type of engagement.
One big theme in your book, I think parents might hear this and think, oh my God, I'm already trying to feed my kids and make sure their sheets are clean and whatever, and to have a job and things like that. I can't do hour-long reading lessons every day too. A lot of the stuff, so much of the stuff you're talking about is stuff we can work in to our daily routines, right?
Yes. And there are so many opportunities in the day to build these things in. When the child is waking up or at a mealtime or bedtime or bath time or any of those routine moments, all of those everyday occurrences can be reminders to engage around language. One of my favorite examples is, I talk in the book about phonemic awareness, which is building awareness of the sounds within words. And I talk about how to do that with nursery rhymes and songs and wordplay and different things. And one parent, as a reminder to sing nursery rhymes, got a changing pad for their diaper changing station that had nursery rhyme imagery printed on it. And so it was just couldn't be a more timely reminder. So we often think of reminders on our calendars and clocks and things like that. But those physical reminders in the space where you're engaging in something with your child every day anyway are great opportunities to teach in a fun, playful way.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Susan?
Hi. I'm a grandparent of a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old toddlers, and my daughter is career-minded, and her husband is too. They got busy lives. I want to support them. I want to help the grandkids out learning literacy and that. I can buy them books. I can buy them gifts for reading and that, but it may sit there. Do you have any tips on grandparents, how they can support this lifestyle?
Grandparents. Absolutely. Grandparents are so critical. Both of my daughter's grandmothers have played a major role in her literacy development. Even to this day, she's now entering 5th grade and is in a book club with one of her grandmothers. So grandparents, we encourage you to get involved as much as you can. But you can teach vocabulary as well, just in your conversations with the little ones and labeling and pointing and asking questions and being sure to keep the conversation going and giving them opportunities to respond and all of that grandparents can do. And you can also teach some of these lessons. You mentioned your grandchildren were 3 to 4 years old. That's prime time to start bringing their attention to print. Many parents don't realize that often when you're reading picture books with kids, they think the story comes from the pictures. They're not always aware that the story lies in those black marks on the page. But even without a book in hand, if there's a stop sign or words on a graphic t-shirt, whatever print is in their environment, you can teach little lessons by just describing that those letters are all made of lines, dots, and curves, and saying, oh, look at that A, it's made with 3 lines, 2 long ones that go this way and this way, and you know, trace the short one in the middle. But that talking about letters and print, naming them, getting them to pay attention to those shapes, all of that really contributes.
Susan, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Maya Smart about her new book, Reading for Our Lives, with advice on building literacy skills for kids even before they go to school. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember learning to read? Were there key things that you think helped you along the way or that you had trouble with along the way as a parent or grandparent? How have you worked to try to help your kids get ready to learn to read? Or do you have questions for our guest on how to do this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with literacy advocate Maya Smart about her new book, Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to 6. You can join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Christina is with us in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. Well, I have been sending colorful cards to my 4-year-old niece ever since she was little. I write a detailed message. She has kept all of those cards, and she'll take them out, and she will read stories. She'll make up stories about what I've said, or she'll look at the colors of the cards or the animals, and she will just talk about what's going on in the card. And that has really kept us connected with each other. And I think it's made her very articulate.
I love it, Christina. Thank you so much, Maya. That fits into a lot of things you talk about in your book, including community, connection with other people as being something that helps develop literacy.
Absolutely. Parents are stressed and starved for time and dealing with a lot of different things. So when you recognize that you don't have to do it all on your own, that you can rely on your network, your relatives, your neighbors and friends, librarians, pediatricians, and this bigger and bigger universe of people who are all supporting your child as a reader, it makes things easier. But connection, communication, all of those things that engage the child and get them interested in print and reading and writing, it's all wonderful.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Your guest has spoken of talking with a child or reading to a child, but I wonder, where does someone or a family comes from a culture of an oral tradition of telling stories? Where does that fit in?
Well, interesting. Tom, thanks. Maya, any thoughts on that?
Yes, an excellent question. And oral storytelling and those rich family and cultural traditions are so wonderful, and they also contribute to reading success. We just have to be clear on the contribution they make. So obviously they make contributions to that child's vocabulary and their cognitive skills, critical thinking, social connection. But what they're not going to get from oral storytelling is that familiarity with print. So they're not going to learn that text moves from left to right and top to bottom of the page. They aren't going to gain familiarity with recognizing the letters in print. So continue with the storytelling, absolutely, and know that it has value and is wonderful and contributes to their ability to understand what they read down the road, and also just to have all of this rich vocabulary and background knowledge to build upon. But know that they also need print awareness, which can come from books or, as I mentioned earlier, text that appears on cereal boxes or t-shirts or in other contexts.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Maya Smart about her book, Reading for Our Lives, A Literacy Action Plan from Birth to Six. Maya, before we go back to our callers, I wanted to get your advice for, say there's somebody out there listening, they're a parent, and they're thinking, hey, I never developed good literacy skills myself. I'm not a strong reader, maybe even a little intimidated by it. Do you have advice for them on how to help their kids out anyway?
The main advice is to play to your strengths and be confident in knowing that the conversation that you have, listening to them, responding to their coos and babbles, and other communication as they get older, all of that is valuable and supports reading and literacy as well. And then even when it comes to teaching specific literacy skills or building their awareness of letters and print, most parents, even if they aren't tremendous readers themselves, know more letters than that three-year-old or that four-year-old. So you can lean into what you do know and be sure to share that. And then you can also look to your community and support maybe story time through librarians for them to get even more exposure to language and opportunities to get familiar with books. And talking to your pediatrician about those developmental milestones and how they're tracking and where they're going and where there might be opportunities to bring in specialists or other support. So definitely do what you can, do it with confidence, do it with joy, make it playful, songs, games, all of that is wonderful.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Juanita is with us in Fitchburg. Juanita, hi.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234.
I'm hearing Juanita's radio. I guess Juanita wanted to mention using music to help words come to life. That sounds great. Let's go to Susie now in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I was going to mention when my kids were little, we used to play the alphabet game while we were in the car. Whether we were in the, out in the country or in the city, they had to find the letters of the alphabet. We wanted to see, especially in town, how fast we could go through the whole alphabet. So they had to look at the signs outside and find A and then B and then sure. C and then, through all the way, obviously all the way through. Also just reminding them that, we read for a lot of reasons, not just in books,
Great. Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, I think the story is I learned my first letter was a letter K because to drive anywhere from where I was, you had to go by the Kmart. And there's a big
yes.
K. But Susie, that's a great example, Maya, of the kind of things we could do, again, without even cracking a book open.
Absolutely. Those everyday opportunities that are fun and enjoyable. So if it's a game, don't think that it's not teaching or that they aren't learning, because they absolutely are. And the more fun and engaging it is, the more time they're going to spend on task building that letter knowledge in that case. But songs, all of that is wonderful. I met someone over the weekend whose son was deemed the king of kindergarten at his school because of his strong reading when he entered school. And the mom explained that he learned it because they had a karaoke business. And he spent a lot of time watching people sing while seeing the text that they were singing, each word light up as they sang it. And so it wasn't with a book in hand, but it was still making that print sounds connection.
Excellent. Thanks for that call. I learned the rest of the alphabet, by the way, from baseball cards, the numbers too. Back to your calls now. Barb is with us in Winneconne. Barb, hello.
Hello. I'm a retired reading specialist. It's been 20 years already since I've been out, but it brought a big smile to my face when I heard Maya talk about her advice, because it hasn't changed in 30 years. It's the same things that we've been telling parents for a long time, so I'm so happy that that's what the message still is. And as far as the grandparents, the biggest reason I probably became a voracious reader was my grandmother. My grandma always had a stack of books next to her chair, and she would read that stack of books. Every week, my aunt would go to the library and look for a new stack of books for her to read, and she was having trouble finding new mysteries that Grandma hadn't read yet. but it made a big impression on me because I saw Grandma read, but I also saw Grandma really enjoy that reading.
Gotcha. Barb, thanks for the call. Maya, the idea of modeling reading for our kids, do as I do, in addition to do as I say.
I think that that's part of it. And I know my daughter learns a lot about how much we value reading from the amount of time that she sees her grandmothers and parents reading. But watching us read doesn't necessarily teach her anything. So that's why I wanted in the book to really break down those foundational skills so parents can teach with more intention in daily life. And as the caller mentioned, they are classics. Like, they're the things that it takes to become a reader are the same things that it took 30 years ago. Vocabulary, the sound awareness, print awareness, letter knowledge, making those letter sound connections. So those are all classics, and parents can benefit from just thinking about them and intentionally inserting those opportunities to teach them.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just 30 seconds or so left. Maya, can you leave us with maybe some resources for more, apart from your book, of course, where people can find more info?
Yes, I encourage parents to take a look at developmental milestones, particularly with the younger kids, so that you are tuned into how much they're growing and developing. And it just keeps in your mind this sense of progress and boosts your curiosity and interest and attention to what they're doing so that you can respond and keep conversation going and ask questions, label and point, and all of those things that we discussed earlier. You really are your child's first teacher, and you can become their best teacher when you become more intentional about it.
Maya, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Maya Payne Smart is a Milwaukee-based literacy advocate. We talked to her back in August about her book, Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to six. You can still let us know about your experiences with reading education. What do you remember about learning to read? How have you handled reading maybe with your own kids? What's worked? What hasn't? If you're a teacher of younger students, what have you seen when it comes to reading skills? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, black cats, bad luck, or good friends? Our next guest tells us about the symbolism of black cats and why superstitions built up around them in past centuries. First, the Attorney General's race is commanding less attention than this year's campaigns in Wisconsin for governor and U.S. Senate. But the state's Attorney General is poised to shape issues ranging from abortion rights to voter access. As Sarah Lear reports, Democrat Josh Call is trying to keep his seat by framing the race as a fight to protect freedoms.
We won't go back. We won't go back.
Let me tell you. At a Planned Parenthood rally in Middleton earlier this month, the theme of the evening was taking control. Attorney General Josh Call told supporters that Wisconsinites lost control over their health care decisions when Republican lawmakers refused to repeal a 19th century law that bans abortions except those done to save a pregnant person's life. And the crowd booed when Call described how legislators blocked a plan by Governor Tony Evers to amend the Constitution so voters could eventually overturn the ban by statewide referendum. But Call, who's running for re-election, says Wisconsinites can still exercise choice on November 8th.
The stakes in this midterm election could not be bigger. Reproductive freedom is on the ballot.
Call's suing in an attempt to get a judge to block Wisconsin's abortion ban. In the meantime, he promises not to charge providers under the law. That's in contrast to Call's Republican challenger, Fond du Lac County District Attorney Eric Toney, who says he would enforce it. Call, the son of former Wisconsin Attorney General Peg Lautenschlager, won his last race 4 years ago by less than a percentage point. Paul Nolet, who teaches political science at Marquette University, expects another very close election. He says it could come down to a fight for focus.
Which of the candidates and which of the campaigns is able to fight on the ground that they're most comfortable with?
Like other Republicans across the country, Tony has focused on crime. And as Nolette observes, Call keeps talking about abortion rights.
He really wants to make this a referendum on, as he kind of puts it, you know, the nature of freedom here in Wisconsin. So thinking about like reproductive rights freedom and the freedom of the vote.
Call pledges to prosecute threats against election workers, and as AG, he fought attempts by Republicans to overturn the 2020 election results. He's also been a reliable ally to Evers. That includes defending the Democratic governor's COVID-19 mandates and siding with him in legal disputes over the boundaries of Wisconsin's new political districts. Tony, meanwhile, accuses Call of mismanagement at the Department of Justice's Division of Criminal Investigation, known as the DCI. He points to staff vacancies and a slowdown in evidence processing at the agency.
We need an attorney general that's actually going to make public safety the top priority and clean up the mess that Josh Call has created at our Department of Justice, at our crime labs, our prosecutors, and DCI.
Call says he expects to be at full staffing by the end of the year. And he says analysts are becoming more efficient at handling increasingly complex cases, despite underfunding from the Republican-led legislature. Tony has also been trying to paint Call as soft on crime, an accusation that Call says is absurd. He cites his time as an assistant U.S. attorney in Baltimore.
I was a federal prosecutor in one of the most violent cities in the country, and I prosecuted murderers, drug traffickers, and gang members.
Call has used the spotlight of the attorney general's office to push for gun control, and he's decried what he's described as attacks on voting rights and reproductive choice. Other campaigns are grabbing more attention than his, but Call is trying to remind voters that they still have a big choice when it comes to the race for attorney general. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow at this time, we'll hear a news feature about challenger Eric Toney, and we'll talk to the candidates here on Central Time tomorrow and Wednesday at 4 p.m. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in two cases involving affirmative action in higher education. The cases have been brought against Harvard University and the University of North Carolina, arguing that they should not be allowed to consider race as a factor in college admissions. The challengers say these policies have led to discrimination against white and Asian American students when applying to those colleges. The universities say that race is just one factor among many in their admissions process, and they fear that without affirmative action, the diversity of their enrollment would decrease significantly. They argue that a more diverse student population boosts the educational experience. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think colleges should consider race as a factor in student applications? If so, how do you think it's important to have a diverse student population on a campus? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tanya Washington Hicks is a professor of law at Georgia State University. Her research and scholarship focuses on issues related to educational equity, domestic relations, race, and children's constitutional rights. She co-authored an amicus brief cited by Justice Anthony Kennedy in the Obergefell marriage equality case in 2015. Tanya, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, can we set the stage with the previous ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, I think going back to 2003. Can you set the stage for us with what happened, what came out of that?
Yes, that was the first time in a case called Grutter versus Bollinger. It was the first time that the Supreme Court actually embraced racial diversity, which is one aspect of educational diversity, as a constitutionally compelling goal. And absent a constitutional compelling goal, the use of race is unconstitutional. So for the first time in that case, citing a 1978 case called Bakke, the U.S. Supreme Court, in an opinion authored by Justice O'Connor, recognized that educational diversity, the educational benefits that are derived from having racial diversity in a classroom, do serve a compelling constitutional goal. The court also said that the pursuit of that goal must be narrowly tailored to that end. And the court kind of restricted the way in which race could be used. In a companion case, also out of University of Michigan, Gratz, the Gratz case, the court said that every applicant has to be independently assessed and compete with every other applicant in order for race to be constitutionally used. And so in those companion cases, both out of the University of Michigan, one, Gratz was undergrad, Grutter was the law school context. The court issued differing opinions. The use of race in Grutter to serve the constitutional compelling interest of educational diversity was found to be constitutional. The use of race in the Gratz case, because the court said it was not sufficiently individualized, was deemed unconstitutional. So that's kind of where we were up until today. There were some other cases, Fisher 1 and Fisher 2 out of the University of Texas, in which the court affirmed its decision in Grutter, recognizing that educational diversity, of which racial diversity is but one important aspect, is still a constitutional compelling goal. And where we are now is we're waiting to see whether the court will reaffirm Grutter or whether it will overrule Grutter.
Let's hear some of the oral arguments in the case. Here's attorney Patrick Strawbridge, who argues that race-based admissions violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
There are many factors in an application like that that might be appropriate to consider, including if they are first-generation college or including if they are socioeconomically depressed. But if the only difference is between a white student and a black student, I don't think the Equal Protection Clause permits the admissions decision to hinge on that.
Can you talk a little more about that argument?
Well, he referenced the Equal Protection Clause, which is the 14th Amendment, portion of the 14th Amendment in the U.S. Constitution, under which uses of race will be scrutinized with a very exacting test called strict scrutiny. And unless the goal that one is pursuing is not determined to be constitutionally compelling, and if the means of achieving that goal are not narrowly tailored, then the use of race will be deemed unconstitutional. Race is special in this regard. It is subject to strict scrutiny because the court recognizes our storied history as a nation with racial discrimination. And so any use of race will be viewed with a jaundiced eye, if you will. And so comparing it to other considerations like socioeconomic concerns, geography, those are not special categories or suspect classifications. And so the use of those of considerations that are based on socioeconomic status or geography are not going to be subject to the same kind of constitutional scrutiny as uses of race will. But I do want to highlight that the use of race is not automatically unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment. Its use must serve a compelling constitutional goal, and it must be in service of that goal using means that are narrowly tailored to that end. And that's where application of the test will frame kind of the court's consideration. The question will be whether the court will continue to recognize educational diversity, of which racial diversity is but one aspect, as a constitutionally compelling goal. If it decides that it's not, then any use of race would be offensive to the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and would be deemed unconstitutional.
And on the other side, here's North Carolina Solicitor General Ryan Y. Park arguing in favor of the affirmative action practices at the University of North Carolina.
A racially diverse and a diverse diversity of all kinds leads to, quote, a deeper and richer learning environment, leads to more creative thinking and exchange of ideas, and critically reduced bias between people of different backgrounds and not solely different racial backgrounds.
So there's that educational benefit for all the students argument that defenders of these policy are making.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you chose that quote. It responds to Justice Thomas's persistent questioning throughout almost 5 hours of oral argument. For someone to state precisely what the educational benefit is of racial diversity. And as a professor of more than 20 years, I can speak to that. The enhanced learning environment that was highlighted in the quote that you played is very important. When you have people in a classroom who are coming to a subject matter from not just different viewpoints, but different experiential points, meaning they've had different experiences that frame their understanding, their interpretation of a particular concept or idea, you get a more synergistic and dynamic learning space versus a more homogeneous space where everyone is coming to the subject matter from the same set of experiences. And so the idea of educational diversity as distinguished from remedial focused diversity, is to take advantage of the racial disparities and the different racial experiences that different racial groups have in America by virtue of our history with race, and to bring that to bear in the learning space, which enhances higher order thinking, problem solving, analytical analysis. All of that is informed and greatly enhanced when you have racial heterogeneity in the classroom. And that's kind of the underpinnings of the educational diversity argument.
We're talking to Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington Hicks about U.S. Supreme Court arguments earlier today over affirmative action as part of college admissions. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it should be a goal of college campuses to have a diverse student body, including steps to make sure it's racially diverse on a particular college campus? If you have questions about these arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Tanya Washington Hicks, law professor at Georgia State University, with us today to examine the arguments in a case before the U.S. Supreme Court about affirmative action in college admissions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Robbie is with us in Marinette. Robbie, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
So I just think that we have universities and higher education, they have a moral responsibility to make sure that their populations are diverse by nature. I don't think that it's going to be deemed constitutional, though, because they're going about the wrong way. You see, it needs to be deemed constitutional because we're giving people an opportunity to spend money. It's not a business denying an employee. It's a business allowing certain customers in. And that's why I think it should be deemed constitutional. I just don't think it's going to go that way, unfortunately.
Robbie, thanks for the call. Robbie thinks it should happen. Tanya thinks it won't. I won't ask you to predict outcomes, but what is your read on what the members of the court said today?
Well, I think Robbie makes an outstanding point in terms of moral responsibility, but that would be keyed more toward the remedial use of affirmative action. But it also speaks to something that was a theme throughout the oral argument today about the zero-sum game nature of college admissions, right? I think Harvard said they get over 60,000 applications for 1,600 slots. So by definition of those numbers, the reality is most people who apply to Harvard, white, Black, Asian, Indigenous, Latino, are not going to be admitted. That's just the hard reality. And so the idea that that Harvard is trying to create a class that is going to give rise to kind of the analysis, the higher order thinking, is a really profound justification. But there's another justification that speaks to kind of the moral responsibility. We want our classrooms to look like our country. We want to make sure that our professional class that relies on diverse members of our society obtaining undergraduate and graduate school degrees so that we'll have Black judges and Latino doctors and Indigenous teachers. We need to have diverse undergraduate institutions if we're going to have a diverse professional class. And if we want, for purposes of our pluralistic democracy, to ensure that people have confidence that the system, that they are represented in the system by which they will be governed, that all requires that we have diverse learning spaces. And so I think his point is well taken, but I also agree with his pessimistic outlook that that affirmative action is not likely to survive this constitutional challenge.
Robbie, thanks for that call. Matt joins us now in Madison. Matt, hi.
Hello. I think it's long past time for affirmative action to go. Choosing who gets to attend a school based on their race is no different than choosing who gets to go to a restaurant or who gets to go to the department store. we're only going to allow a certain number of a particular race into a business, that's inherently racist. And you're never going to end the idea of questioning whether somebody got their degree because of the color of their skin versus the integrity and knowledge that they bring to the profession. You're never going to end this. Universities should be blind to color and name. You apply based on every other demographic, but they don't get to see your name. They don't get to see your race. And then you can be assured that the people that are graduating got there based on their merits and not based on the color of their skin.
Matt, thanks for the call. Tanya?
Yes, Matt speaks to the meritocracy, which maybe up until 3 or 4 years ago, I think would have been a more persuasive argument. But the Operation Varsity Blues scandal, which revealed that wealthy, generally white parents were paying for pictures of their children to be photoshopped on to the crew team, for instance, and they were getting athletic scholarships based on this fraudulent representation of their extracurricular involvement, and they were paying for people to take standardized tests to get perfect scores that were then attributed to their children, despite the fact that the children didn't earn those scores. So this has been going on for some time, which calls into question, and I think really undermines the myth of the meritocracy, that people who are in these or attending these Ivy League institutions are there only by virtue of their performance or their competencies. I also think that, and his comment referenced this, legacy admits, which I guess you would eliminate if you eliminate the name of the person as part of the application. Legacy admits kind of lock in privilege, because at a lot of these universities, there was an overt policy of racial discrimination that prohibited Latinx, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color from ever attending those institutions, which means that their descendants cannot qualify for legacy admissions. And so we have a lot of policies that are rooted in racial realities that advantage people in the applicant pool. But the way that affirmative action is framed in the public eye is that it's giving people a leg up, when in reality, absent affirmative action policies, we would be left with kind of our historic and continuing practice of discriminating against people of color and working class white folks who are often kind of left out of the conversation. We need our universities to be able to consider race so that they can create the most diverse group of students, so that they can capture that intellectual and educational yield that benefits every student in the classroom.
Matt, thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Tanya, is this just about colleges and universities, or could a ruling in this case have effects outside of higher education?
That's a great question. And it makes me think about Brown versus Board of Education, which was decided in 1954, in which many of the justices referenced today and asserted for different propositions with respect to how this these cases should be resolved. Just like Brown had an impact beyond just K through 12, it helped to desegregate other spaces in our society. This decision will have the reverse effect if the court does not uphold the constitutional use of race in admissions. I think we will see in employment sectors, in housing sectors, in a number of different contexts, we will see the government pushing back on the consideration of race and the use of race to achieve equity. And I think that's going to be problematic for our society and for our democracy.
Tanya, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was an enlightening conversation, and I appreciate all your callers for calling in.
That's Tanya Washington Hicks, professor of law at Georgia State University, with us today to look at a case argued earlier today before the U.S. Supreme Court challenging affirmative action. Two cases, actually, in college admissions. Still time for you to weigh in with your thoughts. You can email ideas@WPR.org and head over to WPR.org for some coverage from our friends over at NPR. coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. If you don't have sleep apnea, there's a really good chance you know somebody who does. The sleep disorder affects millions of people in the United States. Kate's guests will share some of the causes and the consequences of sleep apnea, plus take a look at treatments and solutions. And if this is affecting your life, they can tackle your questions. Email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then tune in tomorrow morning at 8. That's here on the Ideas Network. On last week's edition of Food Friday, Wisconsin food writer Jennifer Rude Klett joined the show with some seasonal and simple foods that use local fall produce. Well, we asked what you were cooking lately. Some of you shared your favorite fall foods during the show and some on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James says a lentil and vegetable soup. And James, Jennifer was right there with you on the lentils. That's one of the recipes she shared with us, a French lentil soup that she promised wasn't going to be too fancy. You can find it, plus a couple others, at WPR.org/Food Friday. And Jacqueline wrote that she was making a yam apple cranberry dish with a maple syrup, orange juice, ginger spiced sauce. Sounds pretty good for Thanksgiving, too. Now, I was inspired to make one of my favorite fall foods, a squash soup. Can't really share the recipe, though. For this soup, I have a special ingredient. There's a Thai restaurant I like. The main dish I get there comes with a lot of extra yellow curry broth. I save it, use it as a key ingredient in the soup. Came out great. Is that cheating? If so, I don't care. It's food news you can use. This is Central Time.